Welcome to Yarning Disability, the FPDN podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Namok Jr. I'm a proud St. Paul Badu and Caribbean man from the Torres Strait. And I'm also the son of the designer of the Torres Strait Islander flag, Bernard Namok Sr., and an advocate for the First Peoples Disability Network. Join me now on Yarning Disability as we showcase First Nations people living with a disability, as well as their families and carers, and other industry professionals.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are warned that the following podcast may contain the voices and names of people who are deceased. The First Peoples Disability Network and the producers of this podcast recognise the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past, present, and the future leaders of tomorrow. FPDN would like to acknowledge our founding elders and their lasting legacy, Uncle Lester Bostock and Auntie Gal Rankin, and acknowledge all First Peoples living with a disability.
In this episode of Yarning Disability, you will hear from Juanita Haynes, a Yamaji woman living in Albany, Western Australia. In 2013, Juanita was starting to be a nurse when sadly the GP administered her with the wrong vaccine dose, which had caused a disability. She yarned with FPD and Rosie Binder about the reaction it caused, how it changed her life, and her journey to recovery.
My name's Juanita Haynes, or Nita for short. I'm a Badi Mai Yamaji woman, but I'm living on Noongar Budja at the moment, which is in the Great Southern down here in WA in Albany. I've usually been in Perth. All my family are from Mount Magnet and, you know, Quitting Now Station, all Clinch Mob. It's just been a interesting journey. You know, I've lived in Juro, I've lived down in the Great Southern, I've lived in Perth, so I've seen a bit of the country here and everywhere. So
you're very well versed in WA and the geograph of everything, and you've come from the Midwest all the way down to living in the freezing cold Southwest.
The only thing I haven't done is the big north.
A good trip. So you have acquired a disability that you weren't born with, and you have acquired it later in life. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your disability, your diagnosis, and what your sort of challenges are with this disability?
Yeah, so my disability is kind of like the journey of where it's a bit of like being the urban legend. So, you know how you hear that story about, oh, this happened to a friend of mine. I'm that person. So you never think you're going to end up that one person. Friend. That one friend who, you know, but you hear this crazy story about, but something crazy's happened with them. And that person is me. So, back in 2013, I was studying to be a nurse. And I went out to get ready for my prac. And unfortunately, the GP at the time administered me with the wrong vaccine. I should have been given a booster. But instead, I was given the child dose, which is the initial dose. And that went on and caused a massive adverse reaction. And I ended up with left-sided hemiparesis, sleep disorders, chronic pain. And it went on to change my life massively, you know, and that's what we're going to yarn about today. But, you know, it's the journey of, you know, when you're a patient in the medical system, and, you know, when you're given a diagnosis without any thorough investigation or to exclude any other causes, you know, in my journey, you know, you get treated with the presumption that you're guilty, that your diagnosis is that it justifies any lack of compassion or dignity towards you, you know, and that was my experience. Later on in the piece, I'd go on to study law, and I found studying the law was very attractive because at least there's a presumption of innocence.
Yeah.
But when you're, you know, when you're in the medical system, you know, you've very much taught or treated, you know, to be almost guilty of something, even though you've done nothing wrong. You know, you're guilty of your diagnosis in a way. And it's on you as the patient to have to prove otherwise.
Yeah.
This is on you, which isn't fair because you're not medically trained. So, but the biggest thing in my journey is that, you know, there was a big myth that probably still is around today, but there's no difference between an adult booster and a child's initial dose. But there is, and that's why our vaccination schedule is designed the way that it is. And, you know, there's no tinfoil hats here. You know, in my case, it wasn't the product and it wasn't the manufacturer, but we're talking about a medical error. So it's where the doctor has administered a product that had it been given to a child, it'd be fine. But because it was given to me and I was 25 at the time, it went on to cause some pretty catastrophic, you know, symptoms, and it changed my life. I acquired disability from it. And, you know, before COVID, there existed two extremes, you know, that I witnessed. There was always the very anti-vax and there was always the very pro-vax side. Mm-hmm. But in a post-COVID world, a middle ground arose where vaccines and adverse reactions people started talking about those things more. So, you know, later on, we'll yarn about how my medical error was clinically verified by immunologists, because that in itself took many, many years.
Yeah.
To happen, you know. But when the medical error occurred, you know, it did go on to cause what they call left-sided hemiparesis, so it kind of affected me like a stroke. But my medical records would show that from the moment I was in emergency triage, the staff acted on their own prejudices, and as a result, I didn't get any of the correct imaging done. I didn't get any of the appropriate blood tests done. I wasn't referred to immunology, but instead I was admitted as a neurological patient with psych input. And you basically get told that if they don't have, you know, no interest in investigating it, because in their mind it's like, well, there's no difference between an adult's booster and a child's dose, so why should we investigate it? So they pretty much wrote me off as being psychogenic, you know, and the staff at the time kept trying to blame it on, you know, but the fact that, oh, you just had a bad childhood. But my life had been the best it had been prior to that medical error. You know, I'd escaped a pretty horrific home environment. And that was, you know, custody when I was growing up with the, you know, white side of my family. So that wasn't with my mob side. And, you know, I survived a domestic violence relationship before meeting a man who would be now my husband. And enrolling into a nursing degree and receiving a scholarship, you know, I had a stable home life, a relationship, circle of friends, and it felt like to me and everyone around me at the time, when I had the adverse reaction, that the staff were effectively utilizing past traumatic experiences that had no bearing on my life at that point whatsoever, just to justify their own lack of investigation. You know, it felt that way, you know, and I felt like I'd been shamed, you know, that even though I'd done what I thought was the right thing by undertaking years of counseling to heal from the past experiences, you know, the moment my physical symptoms and circumstances around those symptoms were beyond belief of the staff, I was made to feel like I was insane, and it felt really violating. You know, I felt I'd been shamed, but even though I'd done what I thought was the right thing by undertaking years of counseling to heal from my past experiences, the moment my physical symptoms and circumstances around those were beyond the belief of the staff, I was made to feel like I was insane. You know, it felt violating to be effectively shamed for being unable to feed myself, stand or sit upright independently. Yet I kept being told by the staff that it was all in my head, that I could move if I really wanted to, but everything I was experiencing was somehow my own fault and I just needed to try harder.
And I think that for us, especially at FPDN, as part of our training and engagement, we're actually doing human rights training. And what you just said then is actually why we need this human rights training. So Uncle Lester Bostock, one of our founding elders, began creating the human rights training, and now we're growing that. This is why, because when things like this happen to our mob, they need to know what their human rights are. And you effectively went through this process without basic human rights. That's not okay. And what I want to lead that into our next part of this conversation is the reason you even had these immunizations and these vaccinations was because you were a nurse going to do your prac. So you're an educated woman who's doing something that's required of you to further your study and gain those certificates. And here you are now walking out with a disability at the hands of somebody else.
Exactly. So, you know, and I will say again, but, you know, if another nursing student had gone and got the correct booster, they wouldn't have been an issue, you know, but for whatever reason, the GP chose to ignore the instructions that I had from uni as to what, you know, immunizations we were required to have to go out on prac, and they took it into their own hands and utilized the initial dose instead of the booster. And that's been, you know, something that's very difficult to live with, you know, because I had to watch my friends go on to complete their nursing degrees and I couldn't continue with it. So it did break my heart to feel like, you know, I was happy to see them graduate. And even now I'm, you know, still got them as close girlfriends and, you know, seeing them go into their careers has been amazing, but it broke my heart. You know, it's almost like being a football player and you injure yourself and you can no longer play, you know, like it breaks your heart to put so much time and energy into something and you're out, you know.
And the shoe's on the other foot. Now you've become a patient. Everything that you've worked hard for to become the nurse, to look after people, you've now become the patient.
Yeah, it was really hard because you basically have so much respect for this profession because you're about to go into it. And then all of a sudden the tables turn and all of a sudden I was on the receiving end of a lot of physical and verbal abuse by staff, including nurses. And that was horrific. You know, that kind of turned my world upside down because I saw nurses as my friends. I saw nurses as, you know, safe people and to then go into this environment and this experience of, suddenly you're on the other foot and, you know, they're not, you know, safe people. And, you know, it wasn't just nursing staff. It was, you know, doctors, it was physiotherapists, you know. I went for a lot of really bad experiences in that first admission, but probably the worst was being restrained to a physiotherapy bench, which is called a plinth, and when I was paralyzed down one side of my body. You know, and that was a horrible experience, you know.
As part of your disability, one of the symptoms was mobility, wasn't it? So tell me a little bit about, like, how, to what extent was the mobility?
Well, effectively, as a broad lens, I had to relearn how to walk, talk, read, and write all over again without any real support from the staff. So my left side was completely dropped. You know, from my face, through to my left arm, through to my torso, through to my leg. And it took a really, really long time to get that back. You know, and later on we'll yarn about it, but, you know, there were spinal injections along the way that went a long way to recovering my left leg. Despite the years of physiotherapists treating me like it was all in my head and that I could move my left leg if I wanted to. It actually took spinal injections for that to happen. So,
wow, that's and spinal injections alone, how traumatic that must have been.
Yeah, that was another admission later on that came with its own experiences.
Where in the timeline was all of this sort of happening? So after you've been administered the wrong vaccination, how long was it until you were admitted to hospital? And then how many hospital visits did you have before someone would actually listen to you that this was going on?
Well, with the administered vaccine, it was a slow burner. So it wasn't like an initial bam reaction. It took a couple of weeks for my body to degrade to the point where all of a sudden I woke up one day, the left arm was dropped out, the left leg was dropped out, and then I ended up in hospital. And that does correlate with some of the medical articles that are out there, that timeline. So it's a known timeline for that to happen because it matches up with the same timeline, but it takes your body to develop immunity after you've gotten immunization.
Yeah.
So by the time my immune system had responded fully, that was when the symptoms were starting to come through. I had a letter from the GP's office where it was administered, saying that they had concerns, saying, that it was an adverse reaction. And I still wasn't believed by the ED. And then I was in hospital for about 3 months, I think it was, the first time. I wasn't in rehab for the physical rehab side of things. I wasn't there for very long because their mindset was, oh, it's all in your head. We don't have to provide you with any real equipment. By the time I was discharged the first time, I was only in a standard manual wheelchair that I had to teach myself how to power and steer with my right foot and my right hand. Because, in their minds, in the start, the minds of the staff, there was no need to provide any mobility equipment that would give me any dignity or let alone any quality of life. And because of that mindset of it being temporary, it also meant I wasn't eligible for any support through Centrelink, Disability Service Commission, or any other disability supports, organisations at the time, And I ended up readmitted a few months later, down the track, which is no shocker. And I ended up back in the physical rehabilitation, and the staff were just really frustrated at the fact that I was back in their ward. And I'd faced more physical and verbal abuse, and it kind of made me realize that the only person who was invested in my rehabilitation was me, and after I got discharged for the second time and facing more physical abuse in my second round of rehab in the home, the partner and I went, we've got to go into debt. We've got to go into private system because it's very clear that I'm ending up worse off every time I go in and every time I tried. So we did that, we went down that path of the private system, and we had a physician who found there was a myriad of irregularities with the tests. I was referred to a neurologist who was a professor, and the week before Christmas, December 2013, his findings was that it was not psychogenic because of the pattern and the way that everything was occurring, but yet to be an identified organic cause. And because, this professor operated in the private system, there was limits to the resources and facilities he had available. So we kind of had to remain engaged with the public neurologists. And, there were times I would have doctors and ED mocking the professor's opinion while they laughed at me and ran with the public system's approach of it being psychogenic, and they just wouldn't take any of my relapses seriously. Well, as to this day, there is a very obvious trend of there being a neuroimmune component. Anytime something rattles my immune system, it's going to rattle my nervous system, basically.
Your mobility, like, did you ever recover from your mobility or your symptoms? Did they ever get better?
It was a really long journey. I got to a point where from the advocacy side, I felt like I'd exhausted what the neurology could do and my state could explain. And because they just continued to refuse to refer me to any other specialists, including immunology, I exhausted every health and disability advocacy service, legal avenues, countless letters to whichever politician was the health minister at the time. But, even though I had been put into the too hard basket by the system, life doesn't stop. You can't put your life on hold by holding your breath and hoping that the doctors will believe and start treating you like a human being. So, it was through a lot of...
This is the thing now. You had to self-advocate. Like, if you weren't that person who was strong and could do the advocacy for yourself, which is what, at FPDN, we're an advocacy organisation. So... for you to then have the strength to step up and advocate for yourself for A, basic human rights, B, treatment, C, diagnosis, and the list goes on. What are your thoughts on that alone, like on the fact that if you weren't this strong person who was educated, who, you know, had been around the system for a while and knew that there was something wrong, where would you have been? Like, this is so sad.
Well, there's been a big journey, because by the time I got engaged with sleep specialists and had my sleep disorders diagnosed, and by the time I started engaging with pain specialists as well, that came into the picture of, building that mobility back. But it wasn't until the second year of my law degree that I ended up admitted into hospital again, because after all the years of the left-sided hemiparesis taking a toll and the wear and tear of my spine, I found myself unable to walk, which was really daunting, because I had spent years working so hard to try and get as much mobility as possible with the orthotic leg brace and the back braces and the custom orthotic shoes, to find myself not being able to walk again was scary. And I was facing attitudes from staff based on stigma, which escalated into being assaulted by a nurse. And the hospital staff didn't take my complaints seriously. So I was in the hospital bed, and I called the local police station, and I asked sergeant and constables there, what happens in this situation? And I was told that unless the hospital staff make the call, the police are powerless to act. And it was through that hospital admission, by the time I was transferred out of that hospital, because I ended up in three different, like I've had what, so I had my admission back in 2013, and I had a second admission in 2013. Then I was admitted under private with the professor of neurology. So that's three admissions in 1 year. And then skip forward a few years. And then even though I had multiple visits to ED, I was never admitted. Yeah. But it wasn't until I started undergoing my ketamine infusions that I started getting admitted for treatments. And then this was the admission I had back in 2022 was my next major admission, because I couldn't walk. So by the time I was in that admission, it was three different hospitals across three different months, 3 months, three hospitals.
By this stage, had you got... the doctor that you had seen from the private system, had he then been able to get through to the public health system that this was a diagnosis that has caused disability?
No, ultimately you can have that on paper. Yeah, they can advocate as strongly as possible, but if they're not colleagues of one another, if there's that kind of ego, if there's, that rift, but they're not colleagues, they're not interested. It doesn't matter whether they're more highly qualified than anyone who might be looking at their report. If they're not friends, they're not interested, in essence, right? This next admission, so it didn't matter that I'd gone on to all that effort. It was only until I started getting my sleep disorders and my chronic pain that the picture started to build, because I started getting more diagnoses that were kind of neurologically related, but they weren't done by a neurologist.
Yeah.
So it started to build the picture a bit more. More of the jigsaw puzzle pieces started to come together, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so when I was, it couldn't walk, and I was back in hospital in 2021, by the time I was transferred out of that hospital where the assault had occurred, I was in really bad shape. I was severely dehydrated. I had muscle atrophy. I had a UTI from a poorly managed catheter, and I was in both acute and chronic pain. And I'll never forget the relief of feeling the transfer, like the feeling of relief when I was transferred, like in the transfer ambulance, and that feeling of it driving away from the hospital. And I had the MASH theme song playing in my head. I felt like I was getting choppered out of it. I was so relieved, because even though I'd had those really horrific experiences early on from 2013, of abuse and neglect, that felt like the closest I had come to dying in a hospital, like that feeling of absolute powerlessness and vulnerability. It was a whole other level. And
no human being should have to go through what you've gone through. It blows my mind. It really does. So
And then, so to, you know, answer about the mobility, because it's been such a big journey, you know, at the second hospital, my usual pain specialist was pretty livid to find me in the state that I'd been left in. And I was put on an IV ketamine drip. I had spinal injections scheduled and imminent physical rehabilitation. And when I woke up from the spinal injections, you know, even though I was too weak to roll independently in the bed, I could feel more sensation in my left leg. And I hadn't felt that since prior to the medical error in 2013. So after so many years of in the public system, you know, being berated and being told you can just move your leg, you can do it, you know, it's all in your head. It took until I had, even though I had pushed myself with getting orthotic leg braces and back braces to try and have whatever mobility I could have with the functionality, it took until I had spinal injections for that leg to fully become operational again. So, you know, it wasn't until by the time I came out of the wheelchair and everything, I became what I like to call, you know, independently mobile, just before Christmas in 2022. And that was free from any back brace or leg braces. So that was the journey of mobility. You know, it's taken a very long time and a lot of different hospital stays. But, you know, even though I did that 3 month hospital stay, and you know, I had everything that happened to me, and you know, getting chop it out, you know, with the MASH theme song in my head, you know, I still remain studying one unit of my law degree. You know, I also commenced as an advisory member on the Your Story Disability Service Support Service, which is all that was tied in with the Disability Royal Commission. You know, I became a member of the Indigenous Legal Issues Subcommittee via the Law Society of Western Australia. You know, and after that discharge, I was in a motorized wheelchair because it took me a while. You know, I was still pretty weak, but they managed to rehabilitate me to the point where I could actually have the core strength to sit upright at least. And you know,
So Nita, while you were dealing with the medical industry and fighting for your basic human rights, dealing with all your symptoms that you had, a brand new disability, years of this self-advocacy, you also were maintaining your life, and still being a part of the community. So you still threw yourself into your work, your study, your community space. Tell us what you've been doing. It's unbelievable.
For a while there, I was involved in the suicide prevention space, you know, and then around that time, you know, between the demands of volunteering and advocating, you know, via advisory, the expectations of taking a more of a client load and the role that I had without a pay rise, I found myself being in very high demand. And it was time that I needed to take a step back and limit over obligating myself, because I think that's one of the biggest things when you find yourself in these advocacy spaces. I don't like using the word burnout, but you are prone to over obligating yourself because you feel like you got to be there and try to support and be a voice everywhere and to everyone, because that's where the demand's coming from, basically. So I had to instead focus my time and energy where it would do the greatest good. And it was around this time that my sleep disorders and, you know, were starting to be established, and I began my relationship with pain specialists and started on the first few rounds of ketamine infusions. And that was an interesting journey in itself. So I had that journey kind of running parallel with everything that I was going on with. But, you know, I'd find myself elected to be on the council, to be a council member on the Ministry Advisory Council on Disability WA, where I served my 2 year term. Around a similar time, I'd volunteered in the ATSI LGBTIQ causes and to open up the space and opportunities for mob to speak in spaces. But it's historically been, you know, even though they were rainbow friendly, were dubbed as being white spaces. I also became involved in the voluntary assisted dying campaign due to my experience in the suicide prevention space. I knew when it came to intersectionality of disability and mob suicide and VAD are not one and the same, but they do share a symbiotic relationship. That's my opinion. I was one of two disability advocates who were openly pro-VAD in my state, but the involvement in that campaign became pretty personal when my nana became palliative and passed away during NAIDOC week in 2019. My nana, who was the last living descendant of a generation of the clinchers, spoke of her disappointment that VAD wouldn't be available to her. And, you know, she'd worked in aged care homes for her life. So after her passing, you know, I shared my nana's story during the VAD campaign. And I also made sure that any pro-VAD events in WA had mental health first aid marshals. So it was, you know, not just having St. John, you know, first aid there, but also mental health first aid. And I volunteered to be one of those marshals, so leading by example. And that included the rally held at Parliament House there. So, you know, I'd done, you know, even though I had all of this stuff going on in my personal life and the medical journey, I never stopped because to me, it was always about you get to a point where, as I said earlier, you can't sit there and expect the doctors to treat you like a human being. So you need to be able to turn what has hurt you into something that will hopefully not hurt others. So you need to, you know, find a cathartic way of turning what has been your trauma into something that's going to go on and help others. And that was the one thing that always kept me going, you know, to be not only be able to fight my own battles on my personal front, but it helps you to feel like you still have a purpose after everything you've been through. And as dehumanizing as the way, you know, the treatment I received, it was nice to feel like you were still human outside of anywhere clinical, you know.
I think your courage really shows, you know, that your positive attitude. I know I can tell, you know, we've had a few chats now and you do have that that light and that nice light and airy sort of, you know, feeling about you, that you're a person that has that positive attitude. And yeah, I think that's what kept you going. But I also know that as part of your story, and hearing you speak about your disability and the medical world and everything you fought for, and then your place on committees and even with the VAD, you know, your place in that, I can see why your life was a great segue into what you're studying now as a law student. So
yeah,
a law student as well.
Yeah, it wasn't something, you know, I just, it was always something that I took a lot of pride in, was studying and education. You know, when I moved out of home at 16, you know, I was always, you know, in the academic extension programs at school, I was always very ahead. But when I moved out of home, I always feared that I would lose that. And, you know, luckily I ended up taking a bit of a different path. I ended up not finishing high school, but I was in uni at 17. So I kind of missed a step and jumped two steps forward in a weird way. So I ended up at the Kulbardi Centre at Murdoch Uni. And that kind of made up for not finishing high school. And, you know, I always took a lot of pride in my education. And, you know, it wasn't until I got out of the domestic violence relationship and everything else that I started to re-entertain going back to uni. So that's when I ended up in nursing. And then nursing got put on the back foot. So, and then there was a little while there where I did try to attempt to do a diploma of counselling by correspondence, but then the provider ended up in involuntary administration. So I ended up with a diploma on my hex that I never received. And it took a number of years for that to be cleared. So by the time all that had happened, you know, I was finally at a point at the end of 2019 where I had undergone, you know, about 3 ketamine infusions by then, I think. And it felt like my brain had woken up and was regaining previously lost cognition, but on top of gaining more physical functionality, because the chronic pain was being managed, you know, I'd make the joke with the pain specialist, but I felt like the ketamine had brought me back to life, like the old movie, The Reanimator. So anyone can remember that, you know, but it does. You feel like you're coming back from the grave, but you're alive. It's a weird feeling. And I'd finally reached the point where I thought, you know what? I think I can go back to uni. I feel like my brain's back there, where I could try to tackle this. And so I did it as a bit of a social experiment. I thought, you know what? What's the worst that's going to happen? I'll fail. So I went back and went, you know what? I'm going to roll the dice. I'm going to try my hand at studying law because of everything I'd been through. And you know, so I went back and you know, before I started my law degree in 2020, I went into the nursing building because I went back to the same university where I tried to start doing my nursing, and to see the scholarship board because the girlfriends had told me, oh, you know, your name's up there, and I'd never had the opportunity to go see it myself. So I went to see it in person, and there was my name in the year 2013, and it felt like looking at my own gravestone because it's like a monument to the version of me, of who I was prior to acquiring my disabilities. You know, that moment my life had pretty much died as I knew it, you know, at 25. And so that was a pretty big moment, but it helped me to get that closure to then be able to start my first year of studying law. And you know, I went on to be awarded another scholarship. I achieved average grades of distinction to high distinction, and I felt like my life had come full circle, you know, since acquiring the disability. So, you know, it gave me a lot of pride that it didn't matter everything that I'd gone through, it was paying off because I was able to reclaim, you know, that side to me, which was academia. You know, that was always something that, you know, I had the brain for, and
Challenges
you
were
know.
challenges at this time, at this point in time, still weren't over.
No, they weren't. They weren't. So that's when I ended up, you know, in my second year of my degree, that's when I ended up in hospital with the spinal issues, you know, from the wear and tear of my left-sided hemiparesis. And you know, I went through that journey of being in the hospital for the 3 months across three different hospitals. And you know, it wasn't until I was discharged, and then went on to continue studying my degree in my motorized wheelchair at the time. And I went on to, you know, do my first elective and my first law elective during the pandemic. And I was the first online cross-institutional student to undertake the Queensland University's unit COVID-19 in the law. So, you know, I tackled that at one of the most controversial times when we were all in the pandemic and all in the lockdown. I was online studying, you know, COVID-19 and the law, and I was the first online student to do that, you know, like from WA, you know, or any other state or territory really outside of Queensland. So,
Cool, because I feel like you're a superwoman. I feel like this is you're definitely a woman who is a pillar of strength, and I know that so many people hearing this podcast are not only going to sit there like I am, dumbfounded half of the time, not even knowing what questions to ask you, because you literally are an outstanding woman, Nita. Like, you really.
Well, I find it hard to see myself like that because I've never been a self-promoter. I've never been someone to toot my own horn.
You
You
just
know, but if you
done.
get me in that space of advocacy or you get me in that space of debating, I'll be fierce. You know, but you know, but otherwise, I'm not really I've always been the person behind the scenes. I've never been the face for things, probably the best way to put it.
Where are you at now with your disability, and what are the next steps for you? I do know that at the time of this recording, you are actually 7 months pregnant, and we're very excited to welcome a new little Coolangah in the next couple of months.
Yeah.
What are the next steps for you outside of your beautiful first baby being born? And
Well,
where do you sit now as far as your disability is concerned?
so you know, it's been a long journey. Never ever thought, you know, we you know, my husband and I would be starting a family, you know, and it all kind of takes us back to where my own self-advocacy really had its breakthrough. And that really came from, you know, a mixture of years of the rehabilitation and getting to that point of having studied a bit of law where I could feel that I was at a point where I could advocate to finally really push neurology to refer me to immunology in the public system. And as a result of those advocacy efforts, you know, after many years, the neurology department finally admitted that they didn't have access to a neuroimmunologist in our state, and that my case was beyond what the outpatients could cater to. So after years and years of outpatient appointments and being made to feel like this was in my own head, they finally admitted they just couldn't cater to it. It was beyond their scope. So I was referred to immunology, and the little academic in me was kind of saying, look up this immunologist, find out what his niche is. So I did that. And it turned out that this immunologist was a co-author to a paper in a medical journal that described a case of a patient in 2013 who was a midwifery student who was given the booster. So what was given what I should have been given, had an adverse reaction, and was referred to immunology, and subsequently they became a topic of a medical journal article. Was, yeah, you can try, you can contrast that to what I went through, right? Where I was a nursing student in 2013, he was given the initial dose, so not the booster, I was given the incorrect dose, not referred to immunology, didn't have any appropriate tests or imaging conducted in that admission, and I was written off as being a psychogenic patient. So, and then after having the consult with this immunologist, I received a letter that changed my world. And it felt like my exoneration. It felt akin to reading a judge's decision, because the immunologist had articulated so succinctly the complexity of my adverse reaction and the medical error, and it included all the World Health Organization coding and classifications. But in a nutshell, what the immunologist said was that there's no contraindication data that exists but explains what the possible adverse effects could be if an adult were to be administered the initial dose, right? But that's only because it would be unethical to even attempt to replicate, like, you know, get a cohort of me, you know, like to replicate those patients to produce any findings. It's that it would be that unethical, so you couldn't replicate it. So there's no data because you can't replicate it, because it's unethical, because it's unethical what happened in the first place. So that's how deep this went. And, you know, it was huge, you know, like I still, to this day, you know, like I live with a lot of stigma. You know, I still have to navigate stigma whenever I interact with new medical staff, but having the validation that medical error, you know, and that the medical error was clinically verified, has made navigating that stigma just a little less awkward, and it's made my interactions with anything medical more humane, you know. And you know, it just, even though I still, you know, I have the best mobility I've had in a decade at the moment, but I never take that for granted. It's always in the back of my head, you know. You know, you got to cherish it while you've got it. And you know, I no longer use my orthotic leg brace. I now have glasses for my binocular vision dysfunction, which was another element that went away to helping my mobility. And, you know, I manage my sleep disorders and chronic pain on a daily basis, but that's still the tip of the iceberg, you know. Like, when it comes to typing, I still type with my right hand. Like, I can only use two of my fingers on my left to type. So, you know, there's still things that are there, even when, if you were to look at me now, and I don't have any mobility aids, you would think I would have I've gone through times in my life where I've had a visible disability, and I've had times where it looks like I have an invisible disability, you know. So it depends where I'm at over the last 10 years, but this is probably the most invisible my disability has been to someone looking from the outside in, you know. But yeah, as to where to from now, you know, like where to from here, the next steps, you know, like you know, in my third year of studying law, I went on to publish a legal article called Something About Us Without Us, which I researched, and it, you know, was published, and it highlighted the lack of ATSI disability, you know, data, whilst questioning the integrity of what little data does exist. And, you know, now I'm a fourth year, you know, it was a really hard decision to have to take a break from my degree, you know, to because of the pregnancy, and you know, that means you have to come off a lot of the regular meds. So studying was a kind of out of the picture, and you know, in comes imminent motherhood. But you know, it's one of those things. It happens, but all because I've taken time off uni to start, you know, getting ready to be a mum. You know, I'm still in demand. I recently got endorsed as a volunteer board director for one of the largest non-for-profit NDI providers down here in the Great Southern, and it was just nice. But after 4 years of studying law and everything I'd been through, just to have something tangible, you know, because there's always that fear of not being, you know, because of what happened with my nursing degree, there's always that fear of not going back, or there's always that fear of not being able to go back, you know, and finish what you started. And so it was just kind of nice,
I
you
think
know.
you're driven enough and motivated enough that I can see you completing this. And if you don't, I know you're going to be successful either way. You're a pretty deadly woman, and you've the things you've done so far. What is a day to day? What is it like trying to manage sleep disorders and trauma and chronic pain? What is the like? What is what? Does a day consist of for you, especially now that you're 7 months pregnant?
So for me, it's been a real big challenge coming off a lot of my regular meds. You know, I can be asleep for 3 to 4 hours straight during the day. I can just involuntarily just crash out. You know, I can be walking along. I don't have narcolepsy one, where that's narcolepsy cataplexy. I've you know, suspected narcolepsy two, so that's without cataplexy. So I don't do any full big drops like in the movies. But I can be walking along inside, and then it's almost like you'll suddenly catch yourself snoring while you're standing up,
Yeah, right. Wow.
and you've gone off into a micro nap. So even though my body hasn't done the full drop, my brain is still kind of semi-ticked over into a, you know, not being fully awake. And you know, I'd get that, you know, I get micro naps even when I am fully medicated for my narcolepsy, but not to that degree, you know, not to the degree where I'm catching myself almost in a snore standing up. And then my chronic pain, you know, the difference is that, you know, I have, you know, under medical advisement, I have remained on my ketamine, on a daily basis. And I did go off of it, for a brief period in the first trimester. And it is the difference between being able to get up out of the shower, like get up out of bed and have a shower, because my muscles just feel so heavy. Like, you know, it's not just a pain. It's not like, you know, there is a pain, but it's not like, oh, I'm in pain, I can't move. I've got nothing to work with. My muscles are so heavy that I, as much as I want to move them, that it is very difficult and very painful to move them. So to even just be able to get up and just do something basic, like go for a shower, that's the difference between, you know, having the ketamine therapy and having that, and not having it. So, you know, you end up just, and it's even more full on than being fatigued. Like it's a different level. And then my spinal spasticity and my muscle spasticity increases as well. You know, because my body doesn't have its regular dose of ketamine. So that just means that your nervous system and your pain signals and your receptors are going more out of whack. So you might, you know, you start getting more spasticity and that kind of thing happening as well.
To deal with like a lot. You think that from all of your medical encounters with the medical system, do you think there's a gap between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, like, I absolutely believe that if I had been left, you know, only to be managed by the public system, I wouldn't be a board director, I wouldn't be studying law, I wouldn't be on the verge of starting a family. You know, I 100% believe that I would likely still be in a manual wheelchair, probably extremely traumatized. My sleep disorders and chronic pain would probably not be diagnosed. And I would probably be getting prescribed a range of inappropriate medications to manage my symptoms, instead of those symptoms being thoroughly investigated. Because, you know, like, even though I've got lighter skin, I had, and I had, you know, private health insurance, you know, whether I was admitted as a public patient or private patient, it didn't shield me from my experiences of the stigma and abuse and neglect over the last 10 years, you know, and that to me, that's the gap, you know, right there. I know the gap exists because I lived in it for a decade of my life, and I'm still a ghost patient when you look at modern medical literature, you know. And from my experiences, I've coined a term as systemic institutionalization, and I've used this whenever I've tried doing policy advisory just to try and get it out there. But to me, systemic institutionalization, it's where an individual can be free in that they've never been to prison, or maybe they're out of prison. Yet the decisions made within a broken system can lead to an individual feeling like a prisoner in their own life, in their own community, you know, and no patient should ever be shamed, ever, full stop, you know. But if you feel like you've been shamed about your health or disability, then that's where you reach out to organisations like FPDN, First Disability Absolutely. Network, and they can refer you to someone who can help, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I would like to say thank you very much for your time. And I know that people listening to your podcast are going to be wowed like I am. And it's also going to have people's brain ticking, you know, because not everybody will have the opportunity to recognize or even have the awareness to recognize that something like this, which is something that's so simple, can have such an adverse reaction and change people's lives. So I would like to thank you for your time, and I really know that we at FPDN are really grateful to hear your story. And I think, we wish you all the best, Nita. We wish you all the best for your new baby, and we hope that you get the answers, and I know that you'll keep fighting for those answers, and hopefully your life is going to take a change for the better, and we'll see you being some big-time lawyer and advocating for our people, which is what we need, more people like you.
Yeah, well, that's the biggest thing. There's not enough advocacy in the medical space, you know, and disability. There's a lot there in other areas, but not in this space. But, you know, I hope that, you know, it'll all be, how to put this, I just hope as time goes on that, you know, for the more that our mob start to gain a bit more accessibility into different spaces, and more presence in different spaces, I hope that, you know, that will then have an onflow effect to our health and our disability sectors. You know, it's one of the biggest things. It doesn't matter how little money or how much money someone whose mob might have, you know, your health and your disability, it's the one thing that can affect us all. You know, it doesn't discriminate. You know, the medical staff might, but, you know, health and disability doesn't. So,
absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
That was Yamaji woman Juanita Haynes yarning with Rosie Binder about how a medical error caused her disability and the after effects from it. Thanks for listening to Yarning Disability. FPDN would like to thank you for coming on this journey, as each week we hear from First Peoples living with a disability and shine a light on the issues they are facing. I'm your host, Bernard Namok Jr. Follow FPDN on our social media accounts to stay up to date with future episodes and information. You can also visit our website at www.fpdn.org.au.